This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Some 20 years ago, Susan Isaacs wrote her first novel, Compromising Positions. The book was a whodunit, and it was a smashing success. The protagonist, Judith Singer, was a wisecracking Long Island housewife. Judith, married, raising two children, and feeling the pull of the women's movement, found herself investigating the death of a lecherous dentist nicknamed Dr. Dirty. Hollywood liked this story. Susan Isaacs wrote the screenplay in 1985. The movie was made. It starred Susan Sarandon and Raul Julia. And that was the last we saw of Judith Singer until this fall. Judith Singer is back in Susan Isaacs' latest novel, Long Time, No See. Now, as you know, in 20 years' time, a woman's life changes, and Judith Singer is no exception. More about Judith Singer and her creator in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Susan Isaacs is our guest today. In addition to Compromising Positions and Long Time, No See, Susan is the author of seven other novels, including Red, White, and Blue, and Lily White. She's written two screenplays and one work of nonfiction, Brave Dames and Wimpettes, What Women Are Really Doing on Page and Screen. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls. Questions and comments are encouraged in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you happen to be listening, call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. Excuse me, 800-222-WILL. Susan Isaacs, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
After such a hiatus, why did Judith reappear?
Well, because I was desperate. I'm in a writer's group, and the group puts out a biennial anthology of nonfiction, and they said, write a short story. And I didn't gasp, but I came close. I said, it's not my form, I can't. And I felt obliged to try. You know, I've done most other forms of writing. I've spared the world my poetry. But I had never tried a short story. And I went home feeling terribly unsure, and then I was pulling into my driveway. There was Judith, and saying to me, well, not in the sense that Joan of Arc heard voices, but she was saying to me, "Look, I'm back. You know me. We've been together before, and why not give it a try?" And I did, and I had such fun with that short story that as I was writing the end, I realized I was going to write a novel using her because I didn't want to give up her company.
Yeah. I imagine one of the hardest things for a writer to do is to retire a really solid character.
Well, actually, that was easy back then because Compromising Positions was my first attempt at fiction. And as much as I liked series detectives, I sensed that if I kept writing Judith Singer novels, they would be increasingly contrived, and I'd wind up writing Judith Singer Goes Hawaiian 20 years down the line. And also, there were other sorts of fiction that I wanted to try that couldn't be squished into that whodunit form.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, though very grateful to her, I said goodbye and went on to try, you know, work with a lot of other characters, a couple of the men.
Yeah. Now, the work that came after Compromising Positions, it contains a variety of stories. How do you begin thinking about the story you'd like to tell?
It's not so much the story I'd like to tell. It's the character comes to me, as Judith did originally, and says to me, I want you to tell my story. I mean, we're in a sort of collaborative way. And some of them have, you know, I felt them very strongly, but I didn't know quite where the story was. That's when I started in Shining Through. I had a legal secretary who I wanted her to do something heroic to prove her worth. It was to a degree about social class. But then in Shining Through, what finally got me got me writing was realizing World War II. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to write about heroism, but I wanted my hero not to be just another guy in a white hat. I wanted to be the woman in the white hat. And that was a perfect era for it. And then the whole novel followed. I mean, it doesn't come in a flash, but I worked on an outline of the plot. And what happens in all the times that you're sort of negotiating with this character, your subconscious is busy on its own little typewriter. And the outline is generally fairly easy for me.
Hmm. And when does that character in the unconscious, you know, break through to the conscious? How does that happen?
Usually... Toward the end of writing, of finishing one book, one or two characters will come to mind, and very often it's one, and that's what my next book is going to be about. Or with Magic Hour, the protagonist was a recovering alcoholic, recovering drug addict, half Protestant, half Catholic, male homicide cop, none of which I am.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to write him, it sounded false. And if when I reread my own work and it doesn't sound right, I know it's not going to go over for readers. So I walked away from him. I said goodbye. I went on to write another book. But then I came back to him. And what had made him sound like, you know, a woman, you know, taking testosterone shots was that I was so self-conscious about writing about a man. But once I got over that, once I decided I'm not going to worry what people are going to say when I write about a, you know, when I write as a man, including about a man's sexuality, then it worked.
Hmm. Now with a short story under your belt, do you think you'll go back to that form?
Well, I have actually for another anthology that writer's group has written, but basically by the time when I get a first sentence, it just seems natural to go on for 500 pages.
Oh. And there's more character in 500 pages than
there's
in a short story.
There's more character in exactly. And I'm also, I probably would be more comfortable in the 19th century because I'm really very fond of plot.
Huh. I don't think you'd be comfortable there.
That's true.
I think you're a 21st century woman.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Speaking of which, was it difficult to come forward 20 years with Judith Singer and place her in a new context?
Well, you know, I debated for a little while, do I keep her as she was at compromising positions at age, you know, mid-30s, or does she get to experience the joys of menopause? Do I have the relationship as it was in the film Compromising Positions, which I also wrote, or do I stay true to the book? And ultimately, the book was it for me, and I decided to make her my own age because there was something I wanted to say about women in their 50s, but I also wanted to have her view younger women, you know, the women mm-hmm. who are now moving into the suburbs, living, you know, taking over all the Center Hall colonials. I wanted to look at their lives, and Judith was just the perfect person to do it.
Yeah. Also, you gave her an education. She's now a scholar of history.
That's right.
She's an academic, but teaching's really not near and dear to her.
No, it's not. I mean, she, as she says in the book, you know, it occasionally has her head, but never her heart.
Mm.
And what she likes is solving murders.
Yeah. I wonder if she was to return again. Now, just this is strictly hypothetical.
Okay.
Do you think she might be writing history? Do you think she might be appearing on, you know, the Sunday news shows
along with Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I think she's a woman with a moderate talent.
Mm.
Not a great one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where her gifts lie are in friendship and detection.
Mm. Well, her honesty would be refreshing on the television.
Yeah. Good.
Speaking of Judith and being a moderate talent, that leads me to ask you about a good friend of hers in the story, mm-hmm. journalist Nancy Miller.
Right.
Was she also a character in Compromising Positions?
Yes, she was.
Okay. I'm going to go back and look for that book now.
And played really wonderfully well by Judith Ivey in the movie.
Mm, okay. Now, what would you like to say about Nancy? Tell us a little bit about her.
Nancy is Southern, is very fond of alcohol, generous with her sexual favors, despite being married, and is much more cynical than Judith.
Mm-hmm.
And but they're dear friends and very protective of one another, and they have great fun together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they would not use the word supportiveness.
They're both smart, and they both possess great wits, or perhaps I should say a great wit. They also share the experience of being part of the second wave of feminism.
Right.
And here at the turn of the century, they're surrounded by younger women who have quit working to be wives and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, the murdered Courtney Logan.
Right.
Tell us just a little bit about the plot of Long Time No See, and then tell us about this thread in the story of these two women, Nancy and Judith,
right.
looking around themselves and seeing women younger than they are and how they're living their lives.
Okay, the book, Courtney Logan, who is magna cum laude graduate of Princeton and a former investment banker, is now home being really an exemplary wife and mother and canner of peach salsa. And she's one Halloween, she disappears and is never found again, or later turns, actually, it won't give away the whole plot. She's found when they take off the cover of the family swimming pool, alas, in the month of May, there is Courtney. And Judith and Nancy, well, Judith mainly, is enormously curious about what happened to this woman. But they're also asking a lot of questions that I had about these younger suburban moms. No one uses the word mother anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of warm, it smells like cookie dough, but moms. So Judith begins to investigate, but she's also investigating what feminism means to these women. Some of her generation remain traditional wives, but Judith herself put off her own career for a while. But the women now are giving up jobs that Judith and her generation would have killed for.
Mm-hmm.
Judith's generation was told, you can do it all, which of course we found out was not true. But this generation seems to believe you can only do one thing, and that is either have a career or be a mother. I'm in the middle of this argument because I had a wonderful career as a novelist And I never had to make that horrible decision. You know, my kid has 103 temperature. Do I leave the house? Do I go to work? And so Judith and Nancy are really, really duking it out over this. And Nancy's argument is essentially, look, women have great educations now. They get these wonderful jobs. And then after 4 or 5 years, they leave to raise their families. And many of them leave not just for take time out from maternity leave or a year or two off, but it's very often a decade or two. And she's saying, what are these women going to do when they're 45, when they have perhaps another 45 years of life ahead of them? Not all of them can reinvent themselves. They certainly can't get back into their professions. What are they going to do if the family needs money, you know, if they don't have a career? What are they going to do if their husbands take a walk? And what's going to happen with corporations, with law schools, with medical schools, who are going to eventually wind up whispering, why should we give this slot to a woman when she won't stay the course?
Mm-hmm.
And Judith says, but look, you and I both took some time off to have our kids, and isn't there something that a mother can give a child that a hired employee can't? And also, after 8-9 hours a day on the job, what's left? What's left to give the kid?
Mm-hmm.
So that's go all, you know, with you know, all of this alleged wit. And so this is what's going on in the book as well.
Yeah. Now, from your website, I have some biographical information about you, and it says that at a time when you were senior editor at a magazine, you left in 1970 to stay home with your firstborn, Andrew.
Right.
And then you gave birth to a daughter, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked at home, freelancing.
Right.
But was it tough to, what was your situation, and how did you, you said you're in the middle of this sort of conversation.
Well, I'm in the middle of it because yeah. I was home on Long Island, and I worked for 3 hours a day when, I started working 3 hours a day when my daughter went off to nursery school, and that was it. That was my work time, and after that I, you know, drove carpools and, you know, made dinner and did, you know, did that role. So, you know, so a certain less laundry was done, perhaps, than in most households. But because I did grab that 3 hours. But I kept living a very suburban life.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what it's like for a woman who has, like, let's say, has like a job like, you know, Courtney had,
mm-hmm.
And then she comes home and stays home, and she does have a startup business going,
right?
But yet there seems to be among this group of women, this younger 30-something group of women on Long Island in the book, there seems to be this, I don't know, they're doing an awful lot of laundry and much more.
They're doing an awful, because these women are, first of all, became mothers generally at a later age than we did. And also, they've had pretty high-powered jobs. I mean, whether they were experienced teachers or lawyers or corporate executives. These are women who understand very well how the world works and are much more sophisticated. So they're much more involved in their children's lives. They're much more involved in the community than we were.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of take an executive approach to suburban life.
Who could be so engrossed, though, with the top-to-bottom house dressing that that goes on?
Well, you know, I mean, I in my normal day-to-day life, still in the suburbs, you know, I meet these women, and I'm friendly with these women, and they, while I felt very isolated despite all this coffee clutch, you know, image of the suburbs, most of them seem to travel in large groups, and almost to, it seems to me, to, you know, to prevent that kind of isolation, but also to insulate themselves mm-hmm. from the company of other women who have continued to work.
Yeah.
And the two groups seem very antagonistic, which also is a an old line feminist seems terribly sad to me.
Yeah. And that pecking order is based on how much money husband is bringing home.
Well, that's what absolutely astounded me, is that for some of these women at home, and, you know, again, we're talking about women who very often, they're able to stay home because, you know, they're not needed for the family finances, or the decision is made to maybe cut back a little, but to have the mother home. But you know, the whole arrangements they make are sort of to boost themselves and to insulate themselves from this the so-called competition, mm-hmm. and that too puts women in a situation of woman against woman mm-hmm. that we thought we had gotten out of.
Yeah. It seems that the part of the liberation movement hasn't happened, and that is, you know, the idea of men being able to make this choice.
No, I mean, once in a while,
yeah.
Sure, there's, you know, the occasional brave man who, you know, stays home. But, you know, it's like a horse that can, you know, count. You know, it's sort of a freakish thing. They get a little piece on some TV feature program, or, you know, they write a book about, I was a suburban daddy, you know, or I was the mom, or something like that. It's not part of the normal social fabric anywhere.
At the same time, I would say that both in the callers that I have calling in on my program mm-hmm. and men that I know, there's a much more active role for fathers and husbands today than there was when I was growing up and my mother was doing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that the fathers today are much, much more involved than their fathers were, and are very often choosing time over money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sure, there are still places, you know, Wall Street and law firms where men work till 10 o'clock every night. But many, many more of the men in their 30s and 40s are saying, this is not for me.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I just want to inject another note into this interesting discussion. I don't neglect to talk about Susan Isaac's sense of humor. It's wonderful because I've read several of her books, and she's always fun.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, you had an article in the New York Times that was terrific, and it was kind of a laugh aloud sense of humor. It comes, and it's very authentic. It feels like New York. It feels like real people.
This woman is not a relative.
No, I'm not. Be nice. Yeah, well, I grew up in Brooklyn.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and you're in New York, in Queens, I guess.
Well, born in Brooklyn and then on to Queens, kind of easternly mobile.
Oh, right. Well, I went west. So, well, anyway, talk about it, Celeste, because
okay.
I think it she's really valuable from that point of view. It isn't as serious as you sound right now.
Yeah.
I'll hang up.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. The caller is absolutely right, and On many an occasion while I was reading Long Time No See, I went and sought out my husband and I said, listen to this.
And he, thank you.
And he laughed out loud. And,
oh, good.
And both of us were happy. And then I went back to reading until the next I had to share something again with him. Which brings me to this question then. How do you make the writing snap? And how do you, you know, there are, you know, it's like a, it's a book where there are so many great one-liners or discussions or dialogues where there's a lot going back and forth, and it's really snappy.
Well, you know, it's snappy in the book. I am far less snappy in life, and I don't know why, but for me, I discovered that when I try to be funny in my writing, it just sounds forced. I make a lousy stand-up comic. And I just write the way I see the world, and I'm lucky that it turns out to be funny. But I find enormous social pressure when I go out and people expect, you know, some kind of Dorothy Parker wit to emerge, you know, and what, you know, what you have is this, you know, slightly overweight, middle-aged woman who's looking befuddled and occasionally terrified. So I don't do comedy. When I was doing this, when I was on the set of Compromising Position years ago, the director needed an extra line or two to get Susan Sarandon and Judith Ivey across a room, and he said, quick, give me a funny line. And I kind of looked around to see to whom he was talking, and then I realized it was me. And it was really a terrifying moment, because that's not the way I behave. It's not the way I talk. It is the way I write.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Judith Singer, though, is that way.
Oh, Judith is wonderful. Yes.
Yeah.
She's very clever. But, you know, if I had to choose, you know, am I a delight at dinner parties, or am I an amusing writer? I choose the latter.
Oh. I bet you're pretty good at a dinner party.
C+.
Well, I was a little intimidated there for a moment or two with Judith in the book, because she's talking with an acquaintance, someone that hired Courtney to do a video of her baby, mm-hmm. and the woman in question is from the Midwest, Indianapolis, and I thought, uh-oh. If Susan Isaacs is as quick-witted, I'm in trouble tomorrow. Miss Midwesterner.
No, no, no. I mean, she just has an excessive fondness for the letter R. But other than that, she's a nice woman.
Writing a good mystery involves lots of twists and turns, mm-hmm. and lots of, you know, possibilities. But the plot has to be really tight.
Absolutely.
How do you construct the outline for the mystery?
Well, first I do it from the detective's point of view, in this case Judith. You know, when you're writing a mystery, you need a very strong narrative thrust, and there's really no meandering in fields of daisies a la the Victorian novel. And then the other two, by the way, if you're hearing strange noises, it's because I'm in Manhattan, and they've decided to grind down the bricks on our building.
Oh, it sounds a little bit like you might be standing near a NASCAR race.
A NASCAR race or in a dentist's office, you know. Some, you know, they're getting even for me for killing off a periodontist in Compromising Positions. But the other thing I do, besides outlining the plot from Judith's point of view, is outlining the murder. Because it's at every point in the book, it's very comforting for me to know exactly what the murderer is thinking, doing, and how he or she is, you know, lying and being, you know, a sly, demonic human being in order to avoid detection. So using those two really straight lines, I then start to write, you know, and occasionally look back at them. I'll glance at the outline. But it's, you know, I'm sure you've heard this from from hundreds of writers. That, you know, there's nothing in an outline. There are no bars. I mean, you can break out any time, and very often you're told to do so by the character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've heard some writers say that outline, ooh, they would never even think of doing an outline. Although, in a mystery, you have to have that plot really tight.
Well, you know, I'm a pal of Lawrence Block, and I think he just writes. And I think so do a lot of, I think writing in general, whether it's a whodunit or a really literary novel, is an absolutely idiosyncratic act. I mean, it's like making chicken soup. You and I may both use dill in our chicken soup, but it's still going to be a different recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no one right way
mm-hmm.
of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something, you know, so many want-to-be writers very sincerely ask me, you know, do I use a computer or do I write longhand? And all I could say, you know, it doesn't matter if you use a, you know, a quill dipped in ink. It's just a tool.
That's the way George Will writes.
And I remember Mary Gordon told me that she loves to sit with a pad and she likes the act of writing.
Mm.
Because I came up through magazines where they want you to, you know, write quickly. So I learned to write directly onto a typewriter, and I just moved up to a computer.
Mm.
And I know a very successful suspense writer who uses voice recognition software.
Mm.
Which,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just the thought of which cows me.
Mm. Now, when you're putting the story down and it's going into the computer, do you read it out loud?
No.
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 Mm. Do you hear it out loud?
I hear it.
Yeah.
I hear the voices. I mean, I hear Judith. I hear Nancy's southern accent. And when I was writing Shining Through, a good part of it takes place in Germany, the characters, as I was writing in English, obviously spoke English, but they had different German accents, which I could also hear.
Hmm. Judith and Nancy, were they as much fun for you to write as they are for us to
read?
Oh,
I had a great time with
yeah.
them. I had a wonderful time. And then I also had a terrific time with the cop, the homicide cop, Nelson Sharp,
mm-hmm.
Who was in the first book and with whom Judith had an affair. And then I had to figure out, well, what am I going to do with him in this second book? And so, did she lose his number 20 years ago? What happened with that? So just examining that relationship 20 years and a lot of wrinkles down the line was fun for me as well.
Has there been a call for compromising positions to be reissued?
Actually, it has been.
Has it? Okay.
It's in a new paperback.
Oh, great.
And so that's happened. And there's talk now of a movie.
Really?
Another movie. But right now Hollywood is, you know, in this economic anguish. So it's very slow talk.
Yeah. Well, also, I wonder what Hollywood would do with a mature woman.
Well, it's a real question because when you sell the dramatic rights to a work, I mean, you basically, unless you're John Grisham or somebody, concede, you know, give up all your rights to them. So they could do anything they want with it. I mean, they could have Drew Barrymore starring as Judith, or they could animate it and use Minnie Mouse. So, would they actually finance a movie for a star in her 50s? You know, it's just wait and see. I Diane Keaton has said that she'd like to star in it and produce it, which would be dandy with me. Or, you know, will someone put up, you know, the money for this?
Yeah.
And I hope so.
Yeah. You wrote a piece for the Writers on Writing series for the New York Times.
Right.
Where you talked about writing Judith in the screenplay for compromising positions. And, you know, they're two very different media.
Right.
But yet I wonder if it was difficult for you to see her changed rather significantly.
It wasn't really, in part because I was doing the writing. So I was doing the changing. And also because she had an intelligent star. Susan Sarandon playing the role, but I approach the adaptation the way any screenwriter would approach a novel, which is taking from the novel whatever is strikes her as being cinematic, and tossing out the rest, and creating what else is needed for the movie. So the Judith in the movie was not my Judith from the novel, because first of all, she wasn't only my Judith. She was Susan Sarandon's Judith and Frank Perry, the director's Judith, and the cinematographer's Judith and the costume designer's Judith, and indeed the hair and makeup woman's Judith. So movies, you know, are such a collaborative medium that it can't possibly be the same character. Also, you know, if you know what Hollywood, if you as a novelist know what Hollywood does to your favorite character in a film, usually it's not an improvement. I mean, occasionally you'll get a Gone with the Wind or Godfather, which you know, arguably can transcend the novel. But most of the time, you're going to be disappointed. And I feel you either do it and, you know, walk away feeling at least you've been adequately compensated for your pain, or you don't sell it.
Your work of nonfiction, Brave Dames and Wimpettes, What Women Are Really Doing on Page and Screen, leads me to ask you, you know, how are women faring in movies today?
Well, I think they're faring a little bit better than they had been. But what concerns me is that there's still an enormous number of movies and novels and TV shows which have women as the victim, women dying, women being sexually abused, you know, emotionally abused, et cetera, et cetera. And they also, I mean, you get films like that Julia Roberts thing's My Best Friend's Wedding, where women routinely betray other women. And I'm concerned about that because, number one, if you repeat the big lie often enough, it becomes the truth. And I think there's a sense among women now that they're being victimized by their culture, by men. There's a kind of, I think the word is misandry, you know, which is, you know, the male equivalent of, you know, misogyny, of women really disliking men. It's even the so-called "oh, it's a guy" thing is really stereotyping, and so the idea of a strong woman, a la Jane Eyre, Norma Rae, you know, Mary Tyler Moore in that original show, you know, someone who has a strong moral sense and a lust for life and a zest, or if she's in trouble, a woman who can, who has the courage to make the right choice under extraordinary circumstances. There aren't that many of those. There's so much women's literature that's written in petty point about relationships, and even when a woman does act courageously in many of these works, it's courage in defense of the typical women's role. In other words, in helping her children, or in Fatal Attraction, defending the family, against what the idiot husband has done. So I'm concerned about that. And in Brave Dames and Wimpettes, I was asking why, after 30 some odd years of a woman's revolution, are there so many victims? And so I had an interesting time writing that. I mean, it was, seeing all those wonderful and terrible old movies, TV shows, and reading all those books was fun. I mean, it's not the kind of thing I'd want to write every year.
Yeah. Thinking of Susan Sarandon, and a good strong role for her was Atlantic City.
Well, Atlantic City, and
that was good.
And certainly the one where I forget the name of the movie where she played a nun.
Oh, yeah, where she played the anti-death penalty character.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I thought that, on the other hand, Thelma and Louise, which was allegedly a feminist statement, I mean, to me, it's as anti-feminist as you get, because, women are victims of something, and instead of taking a kind of intelligent revenge, they go on a blind shooting spree, and then rather than face the consequences of their acts, they drive off a cliff at the end. So, there were a few of those, and the piano that women that women were embracing. I mean, the piano is she's extorted into giving this guy sex, Harvey Keitel, of whom we saw more than necessary, and what's the message there? She was forced into it, but she learned to love it. I mean, that's terrible to me.
Yeah. Well, going back to our caller today, let's wrap up with something on a brighter, funnier note, I hope. What are you working on now?
Nothing.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, it's lovely. Actually, I decided, after 22, 23 years of writing, I could take a few months off and, not then face the prospect of having to learn how to play canasta. So I'm taking a few months off, and then starting January 2nd, I'm going back to a new novel.
Okay.
A new character, and I hope a fun one, interesting one.
Yeah. Now, isn't it interesting that you've got the date all figured out for when?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have to know.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, because I wait till January 3rd, then, it's get out the deck of cards.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, and I hope to have the pleasure of doing it again.
Well, thank you. Me too.
Susan Isaacs has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Judith Singer is back in Long Time No See, Susan Isaacs' latest novel. The book is published by HarperCollins.